So far, we have talked about equilibrium states and equilibrium phases. In particular, we have focused on the properties of different quantum many-body systems in their ground state. The reason why we have chosen the ground state among all the possible equilibrium states is because in the ground state, all the fluctuations are of quantum nature. So we have a clearer picture of what are the quantum mechanical properties of these states. Whereas if we had chosen some mixture of the ground state with other excited states, we would still have an equilibrium state, but the fluctuations would be of both classical nature, coming from the probability distribution of this mixture, and quantum, coming from the expectation value in the state. So we focused on the ground state. Today, we change completely our picture, and we talk about states away from equilibrium. Okay, so from now on, we will talk about a quantum mechanical system that evolves in time. And, okay, so what is the most important thing that happens in nature when you have something that evolves in time? It is the one thing that it never fails to happen, that everyone knows, you know, even humankind has known this from the dawn of the civilization. What is that?
Thermalization.
That something, so thermalization, or more generally, equilibration. Okay? Things are away from equilibrium, but don't stay there forever. Your coffee becomes cold, your beer becomes warm, and so on. And Eddington said that if there is one thing in physics that you should never doubt, is that this thing happens. In fact, he phrased it in a slightly different way. He said, if there is one law of physics that you will be in very dire trouble if you start messing with and you think that it is not true, is the second law of thermodynamics. And in fact, it is true that the second law of the thermodynamics is the only law of physics that has never been updated. You know, conservation of energy has been updated many times, so many times that we don't even are completely sure what energy means, right? Because we change the meaning of energy so that we can fit it in a law that, in some conservation law. And we have changed the way we understand time, the way we understand space, how many dimensions we have. Everything in physics has changed many times. One thing has not changed, this, the second law of thermodynamics. And one of the most puzzling things in physics is, where does this come from? Because we do not have such a law in our fundamental theories. So all our fundamental theories are time reversal. But equilibration, or the second law of thermodynamics, have an arrow of time, right? Things equilibrate, they do not disequilibrate. So today we talk about this problem, equilibration in quantum mechanics, and we see at first why it's not possible, because quantum mechanics is time reversal, and then why it is possible. Okay? So let's set the stage, and let's start with our assumptions. So our first assumption is that we are in a closed system, okay. and closed and bounded system, and that everything that happens is described by quantum mechanics. Okay? So we would have a Hamiltonian, that is the Hamiltonian that describes all that happens for all the quantum mechanical degrees of freedom in this closed system, and there is nothing else. So you know that, and you know that the Hamiltonian is a Hermitian operator, but in a closed system, it is also time independent. Because if the system is, I mean, closed in the strongest possible way, if there is nothing outside, there is nothing that can change the parameters of our Hamiltonian. And it has a pure point spectrum. In other words, its eigenvalues are discrete values, okay? There is not a continuum of eigenvalues. And we know that the Hamiltonian will have a spectral resolution in its basis of eigenvectors. Okay, so this is what happens when you diagonalize it. And these projectors, I will call them pi. So these are the projectors onto the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. We have also said that states evolve according to the adjoint action of the unitary operators, namely, so these are definitions. Calligraphic U means this, it's the adjoint action of this operator, where UT is e to the minus iht. And operators, similarly, just the other way around, U dagger T A U T. Okay. So what do we mean by equilibration? Yes?
You're assuming a discrete spectrum for simplicity or for a fundamental reason?
No, because it is true that in a closed bounded system, the spectrum of all operators is pure point. The only way you can have a continuous spectrum is for an unbounded system. Okay, so this is how our things evolve. Okay, so let me see if I want to put something else on this blackboard. No, let me pull this one up. Okay. So what do we mean by equilibration? Okay, so let's see. What is equilibration? We could mean this fact that you start with some initial state, then this evolves in time, so it becomes phi of t, and then at some point it becomes some other phi that we call phi ec, such that from that point on it doesn't evolve anymore, it has equilibrated, right? Such that if you keep evolving, you do nothing. So equilibration means that we start from some state and we end up with the fixed point of my unitary evolution. Right? This is what we would like to understand as equilibration. And there is equilibration can be trivial or non-trivial. What is the trivial case? The trivial case is that phi is phi ec, right? So the trivial case can obviously be true. We have already studied that. Those are the steady states, the states that do not evolve. If phi is an eigenstate, or if it is the thermal state, or any other state that commutes with the Hamiltonian, it is phi hack. So these states do exist. Okay? For instance, are the eigenstates. They are fixed point of this operator. What I want to show you is that there is nothing non-trivial. So you do not have states that evolve in time, that are away from equilibrium, and reach equilibrium. Either you are at equilibrium from the beginning, or you do not reach equilibrium. You keep evolving. And this is a fundamental property of quantum mechanics. So let us prove it. So let us assume that there is a state such that when I take the limit for t equal infinity, I get to equilibrium. Or better, let us assume that we have a phi equilibrium. Then this is obviously true, right? Because if it is true at some time t, and I keep evolving, I stay in phi equilibrium, okay? If this is true, then it is also true that the limit for t going to infinity of this difference in norm has to be zero, right? The limit can be taken out of the norm. And now let me just write the definition of phi of t from up there. It's ut phi. And then let me use the fact that the equilibrium state is, by definition, a fixed point. So this is minus ut phi hack. But now you see that since ut is a linear operator, this is equal to the limit of the norm of ut times phi minus phi hack. And now we use quantum mechanics. The unitary operator is norm-preserving. You remember we have used it many times, for instance, when we discussed the Lieber-Robinson bounds. And therefore, this is the limit of the norm of phi minus phi hack. Notice that at this point I can even drop the limit, because phi minus phi hack does not depend on time. This is the initial state, and this is the equilibrium state. And we have proven that if phi equilibrium exists, this difference in norm is zero. Therefore, my initial state is my equilibrium state. So all the states that can reach equilibrium are the states that are at equilibrium. So there is no non-trivial thermalization. And that's it. So I just showed you why equilibration in quantum mechanics is not possible. So there is no equilibration of states in quantum mechanics. States do not reach equilibrium, period. They keep evolving, or they are at equilibrium from the beginning. Pretty bad, huh? So what is the other possibility? Do we care about the states, actually? What are the states? What is a state in quantum mechanics? Have you ever seen a state? A state is a prescription to describe the outcome of observations. All you observe are the expectation value of some operators, right? Which we describe as the trace of A of t in my initial state phi, right? So maybe this reaches equilibrium. Maybe it is this object that reaches equilibrium. However, and this is a more complicated theorem due to von Neumann, if you have a pure point spectrum, which is true, then these values, this function, is quasi-periodic. What does it mean, quasi-periodic? That for every epsilon, there is a t such that a t minus a zero is smaller than x. So I get arbitrarily close to any initial value. That's not really periodic because I don't get exactly back to the initial value, but as close as I want. And you know that this thing also happens in classical mechanics, and this is called this time Poincaré recurrence time. And even classical mechanics is quasi-periodic. It's due to the fact that the frequencies on the torus may be not a rational ratio between them. So, in fact, in this proof, which is the quantum mechanical version, it's not specifically a quantum mechanical problem. So expectation values, anyway, let's stick to quantum mechanics, go back to their initial value. So definitely, they never stop evolving. So they never equilibrate. So even our observations never reach equilibrium. In spite of the fact that what Sir Arthur Eddington said, that if there is one thing that is sure, is that this stuff equilibrates. Okay, so either quantum mechanics is wrong, it's just an approximation, or do we have some other way of defining equilibration that is compatible with quantum mechanics? What do you think? What could happen?
What if t is like of the order of the lifetime of the universe? Then you don't care, right? Because maybe like for a long stretch of time, it looks like it's in equilibrium, and then it recurs. So maybe there's no equilibrium in the universe.
Okay, very good. So you say, you know, maybe this t is very large, so for very long stretches of time, it looks like at equilibrium, and maybe, okay, yeah. So this is a good way of thinking of it. So let's see what is that can happen. So let's make this statement precise and show realistic conditions and sufficient realistic condition such that something like what you described can happen, okay? So in order to do this, I first want to make a remark, very important remark. Okay, let me do it. No, let me do it here. Okay, remark one. An equilibrium state, so whatever is the fixed point of my unitary evolution, which we know they exist, at least the trivial ones exist, but in general, must be equal to the time average of the state, where the time average, the infinite time average, is defined as the limit for an infinite time of 1 over t, the integral up to t of phi t in dt. Well, this is an obvious remark. This is just a property of the limits. If a function from a certain value of the variable onwards has always the same value, its infinite average on the whole domain has to be that value. It's calculus one. Okay. And I could also define the equilibrium value of an observable as its time average, the time average so I can call it this way. Well, let me call it. It is A of t expectation value average. And as you can see, it is just the trace of A into phi bar, using the Schrödinger picture instead of the Heisenberg. Very well. They use this notation? Yeah. And let me call this thing, I could even call it A bar. I don't know if I use it, but okay. Okay, so this is the first remark. And let us compute this thing, okay? We can compute it explicitly. So I will have the limit for t going to infinity, 1 over t, 0, t. And then here I will have the sum over all the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian of e to the minus I en minus en prime t phi n n prime e n n prime. Okay. So far, so good, right? Now, let's make an assumption. Okay, so this is a non-trivial assumption. Assumption one. We will comment on all these assumptions at the end. H is non-degenerate. So there are no two different states that have the same energy. Okay. So what happens when n is different from n prime in this sum? That this frequency is finite, right? So you have an oscillating term. And you are taking the infinite average of an oscillating term. And as you know from calculus one, it's zero, right? These are sines and cosines that are bounded by t. And then you take 1 over t. Sorry. Then you take the 1 over t limit, and you get zero. OK, so the only terms that survive are those when n is equal to n prime. But when n is equal to n prime, this is 1. They do not evolve in time. So the average is that value. And you are left with sum over n, phi n, n, the projector pi n. And what is phi n, n? If I expanded my initial state phi as a cat in this way, phi n n is nothing else but a n modulus square, right? It's the diagonal elements of the density matrix. In other words, these are the populations of the initial state in the basis of the Hamiltonian. No, this state is called completely defaced state. So you see phi bar, so phi is some state that on the diagonal will have phi 1 1, phi nn, right? And plus a sum of diagonal elements, right? If I take the time average with the only assumption that the Hamiltonian is not degenerate, it always goes to phi bar, which is just the diagonal part. So that's all the phases are lost. That's why this is called completely dephased state. And it is a simple exercise. Just do it in a basis that it's really simple. That this is equal to the projection of my initial state phi onto the basis of the Hamilton. Okay. So if there is an equilibrium state, it must be the time average. So it must be the completely dephased state. As you can see, under time average, the initial populations are conserved. But time average can erase the phases. However, so we also see why we don't usually, I mean, we cannot reach. Is this in contradiction with what I showed here? No. Because time averaging is not unitary evolution. It's just the time average. I computed something that I call the time average state. And the equilibrium state has to be the time average. And in fact, you cannot, from a state that is not already at equilibrium, reach the time average, because you would need a non-unitary operation to do that. But this is very helpful. We like to have understood this fact. Okay? Now let's see what is that might happen. Imagine, okay. Oh, and then of course my A of equilibrium is the trace, as we said, of A in this state that I call phi bar. So if there is an equilibrium value for A, then it must be this value. It's a given value. It only depends on A and on phi bar, which means on these populations. So let me plot this value on this graph. So here I have t. Here I have my expectation value of a as a function of t. And here this is this a bar. So many things can happen, right? So one bad thing would be if your expectation value is something like this and never stops doing something non-trivial, OK? Or I'm not equilibrating. But what is that is a bit compatible with what we have seen so much, but still gives us a sense of equilibration, is this thing that maybe we start from here, and then we have very small wigglings around this state, around this value. And then sometime in the very, you know, far future, I get back to the initial value. Okay? So this is my Poincaré time t. So in this scenario, my evolution is quasi-periodic, It has never equilibrated. It has never really a trivial behavior. However, the probability that my value A of t is different from the equilibrium value, so the probability that this is greater than some epsilon, is very small. So you see, I've just sketched a behavior, a qualitative behavior, in which A of t has always a non-trivial profile. It is quasi-periodic. However, we do not see it having values different from a bar. Because either these deviations from a bar are very small, or the time in which these deviations from a bar are significant are very small times. So if I observe it on a very large scale time, I never get so lucky to observe a deviation from it. So this behavior is at least not violating our unitarity. So it is possible. We call this behavior equilibration in probability. Okay, so we have established that this thing does not seem forbidden by quantum mechanics. So my question now is, does it happen? And if yes, under which conditions? Very well. So the answer is yes, and now I will show you sufficient conditions for this to happen. All right. So how do we set out to prove something like this? So look at this problem. I want to show that the probability of a value being different from its average is small. What does it mean? What needs to be small?
Standard deviation.
The standard deviation, exactly. Very good. This is exactly why we care about standard deviation. The only reason why we use standard deviation as an important figure when we do experiments is because it tells us that if the standard deviation is small, then this probability is small. And the exact statement of how these things are related is called the Chebyshev inequality, and we will use it at the end of the lecture. But so let us set out to prove under which conditions I will prove that the variance is small. Okay? So I want to prove that A of t minus A bar square averaged, that I will call delta A square t, I want to prove that this guy is small. Or actually, I want to find conditions sufficient so that it is small. Right? So this is the variance of A in time. So this means that I'm averaging. Every time I take an average, it's the average in time. So don't look at this average here. This average now, it's just a way to extract the expectation value. It's the trace. So I take the distance of my variable from its average. That's why I square it. So I have a positive number. On average, it's the average distance of my variable from its average. That is the variance. Or in other words, this is the time average of the square of the trace of A phi t minus trace of A phi bar, right? Because these are these expectation values, A bar and A of t. Okay. So let my in order to prove something, let my define some quantities. So let me define phi tilde of t as phi t minus phi. So I take my state at the time t, I subtract the initial state. Okay. So what is this? This would be the sum of n different from m of phi mu nu e to the I en minus em t em en. Okay, so this is phi bar. Notice that for every k in the usual basis, the energy basis, phi tilde, you can see it from this, phi tilde in eigenstate k is zero. Right? Just sandwich it between k and k, and you see. It is because of this. Well, then obviously, the trace of these guys, of phi tilde t, is zero. All its diagonal elements are zero, so the trace is zero. Okay, so this is a fact. Now, second thing. Consider my initial state phi and phi will have support on some subspace of H, right? So in other words, I consider only the span of those eigenvectors Cn such that An is different from zero. It could be, the support could be the full Hilbert space, but could be smaller. Okay, so let me call this support, let me call it H plus, is the support of phi. It's the effective Hilbert space. Right? My time evolution will not be able to extend the support of a state. The state has to rotate in the Hilbert space spanned by the initial states of my initial superposition, of my initialized state. Then now let me consider the norm of A in H plus. So namely, I take the max for all the states in H plus of psi A psi minus the minimum of these things. And I call this thing A max minus A minus. And this difference, that is basically a way to bound all the expectation values of A, I call it delta A. Okay. Very well. Okay, so now finally, let us compute the fluctuations. Okay, so we want to compute this delta square AT. So it is equal to this, right? But notice that this is equal, you see it from there, to the average of the square of the trace of A in phi tilde. Right? Trace is linear, and phi tilde is just the difference between phi t and phi bar. Oh, sorry. Sorry. Yes. Yeah, otherwise, this is not true, right? Phi bar is the diagonal elements. That's why I'm taking away the diagonal elements. You see it up there. Phi bar is this. Phi n and pi n. So what I'm doing here is to subtract from phi t its diagonal elements. OK. All right. So this comes from the definition. And then I can write this. This is equal to the trace of A bar, A tilde, phi tilde. Why? Because the difference between A and A tilde, I didn't define A tilde. A tilde is just A minus A mean. So I shift A by a constant. OK. So since A tilde is just A minus A mean, when I take this expectation value, it's equal to the initial expectation value minus a number times the trace of phi tilde. The trace of phi tilde is 0, so I've not changed anything. OK? So this is true. And the square is here. OK. So now let me write this thing. So I have the time average of the square of this trace. So let me write the trace of A tilde, phi tilde. OK. So remember that phi tilde is only the off-diagonal elements. So for instance, if I use indices j and k, I have j different from k of a tilde jk. And now I need to write this term, right? Phi kj. And then I have the exponential part. Okay. And then I have the square. So I have to multiply it by itself. So I will have an other two indices, m and n. And again, they must be different. And now I will have a mn mn tilde phi nm. And again, the exponential part that is multiplied. So I get one exponential that is ej minus ek plus em minus en t. And I'm averaging everything. But the only part that depends on time is this one. OK, so this is what I'm doing. So this is what my temporal fluctuations are these objects. And now remember that j is different from k, and m is different from n. Now, assumption two. So what is the assumption two that we want to make? Notice that if this object is equal to minus this object, if this object is different from minus this object, then this is a number that is different from 0. And the time average will go to 0 exactly. Because it's the infinite time average of oscillating terms. So if ej minus ek is different from en minus em, then we have 0. So the only terms that survive are those such that this is true. Only surviving terms. And we know that j is different from k, and m is different from n. So only when this gap is equal to this gap, we have something different from zero. So the assumption two is non-degenerate gaps. It means that this gap is equal to this gap only if this is the same pair of levels. So only if in that situation J is equal K, sorry, J is equal N and K is equal M. Okay, so under assumption two, this becomes the sum over only N and M that are still bound to be different of A tilde N M phi M N A tilde M N phi N M. Right? Because only this term survive when this is one. And then, because there are non-degenerate gaps, J must be equal to N and K equal to M. Very good. And what is this? This is the sum, N different from M, of A tilde MN square, modulus square, right? Because, see? And phi MN modulus square. Okay. So now you see that I can upper bound this quantity. So now I can upper bound this quantity if now I also add the terms N equal M. Because there are positive terms in what I wrote here. So if I add all the possible n m, I have an upper bound. So I know that the fluctuations are anyway smaller than this guy. Okay, let me continue here. And okay. So what does Cauchy-Schwarz equality tell us? That this is smaller than fmm, these, by the way, are positive numbers, phi nn. OK, so I can write this thing again. So this is smaller than the sum over m and n. I open up the a tilde m n square again. And now we have phi mm, a tilde nm, phi nn. OK. And this is equal. So if you write this thing in a basis, so spare me that because it's long, but you just write it in a basis. And what you find is E M a tilde, actually now compares phi tilde, because in the basis you, well, you know that phi mm are actually the matrix elements of phi tilde. So, sorry, of phi bar, it's written there. So if you write this in a basis, you find this, En, En, and then again, A tilde phi bar, En. Oh, but this is the identity when I sum over N. So I'm left with the sum over M that is sandwiched. So it's the sum of the diagonal elements of A tilde square phi bar square, which is the trace of A tilde phi bar square. So the fluctuations are upper bounded by this quantity. Now, with a bit of algebra that you will find in the notes, it's not very difficult, but just a bit long, but it's not very surprising to see that this A tilde can be upper bounded, since here I'm somehow computing the expectation value of this guy, this A tilde should be upper bounded by delta. But because there is a square, it should not be too surprising that this could be upper bounded by delta A square, the trace of phi bar square. Okay? So I'm not saying that this does not require a proof, but it's not very surprising that it happens, and you will find it in the notes. You just need to be very careful how you compute all the expectation values. Okay. So we are done. Okay? So we have found the bound that we liked, and now we try to understand it. So the variance is upper bounded by this object. Okay? So if we go back to our Chebyshev inequality, so what does the Chebyshev inequality say? Says that the probability that a random variable is different from its average more than epsilon is smaller than sigma squared over epsilon squared. So this is called Chebyshev inequality. This statement is the basis of modern science. If you didn't have that, measuring would not tell you anything. It's because the probability that any value in all the possible measurement is different from the average more than a little bit is smaller than this quantity. So if sigma squared is very small, you can take a very good confidence. So let's apply this thing to our case. So what is our x? Is this thing. And what is our mu? Is this thing. So we have that the probability that the expectation value of A at the time t minus is different from the expectation value in my wannabe equilibrium state. The probability that this difference is greater than epsilon is smaller than delta square A trace of phi bar square over epsilon square. Finally. So this means that if this number or this number are very, 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 very small, then I realize that situation with the pink line, that I never observe values different from their time averaged value. It's beautiful. So let's try to understand it. What is the meaning of these things? Okay. What is delta square A? Well, it is the difference between the maximum and the minimum eigenvalue of A in the effective Hilbert space. So let's say that A is a local operator, okay? So it's something that only involves eigenvalues that are of order one. It's not something that increases with the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay? So this is a number that is not particularly small, but So we cannot use it to bound, but it's not also particularly big. It's a number of order one. This is the typical case that we're interested in. We observe something. These values do not depend on how big is the system. Okay? Are local operators, right? So the only real object in play is this one, the trace of phi bar squared. And you remember what is this? So phi bar is just the distribution of probability of my initial state. See? Phi bar is just phi 11, phi 22, phi 33, phi nn. It's the probability of being in the eigenstate at the beginning in the eigenstate of energy n. And what is this? The trace of the square of this. It's the purity. It's the purity of this probability distribution. Or if you want the something that is not really the Turenian entropy, the Turenian entropy is minus the log of this, but it tells you how our initial state is spread out in the Hilbert space. So you see that this number, trace phi tilde square, is always smaller than one when you have a pure state for phi bar, and smaller than one over n, where this is, so let me call it d, the dimension of the Hilbert space. Now, be careful. I'm not saying that the initial state should be not pure. The initial state here, I take it pure. You see? It is a pure state. But if I only take the diagonal elements of it, the completely defaced state, only the probability distribution of being in a given eigenstate, that is a mixture. It's a classical probability distribution that is upper bounded and lower bounded in this way. So if my initial state is not the superposition of many energy eigenstates, okay? So I prepare my initial state in a superposition of three or four energy eigenstates. Then this number is close to one. But if I spread out my initial state evenly or almost evenly in the energy eigen basis, then I reach values that are like one over the dimension of the Hilbert space. So if I have an initial state that is very spread out, this is something that goes like e to the minus the number of particles that we have. Remember? Because the dimension of the Hilbert space is an exponential of the number of particles. So you see that for n equal 10 to the 23, this is a mind-bogglingly small number. So it is very easy to prepare an initial state such that the expectation values of a reasonable operator are always close to their average. You need to prepare your initial state in a particular way. You really need to prepare it in a superposition of just few energy eigenstates in order to have a profile like the white one there, that you have a non-trivial evolution. But pretty much, if your state can evolve in a large Hilbert space because it's the superposition of many states, then you have this, that the expectation value of reasonable operators is always close to their time average. And so this is equilibration in quantum mechanics. This is how equilibration happens. Now, are we done? this is a rhetorical question. Why we are not done? Why we're not, we have not explained all we like to explain?
Assumptions?
Hmm?
We assumed things about the energy level.
Okay, good comment. We have two assumptions. Very good, very good. Now, but there is a, even in the best case scenario, let's say that I justify these assumptions to you. Are we done? The answer is no, because I just proved that A of t has a typical value. It's almost always A bar. But as you can see, A bar is the trace of A in phi bar. And phi bar depends only on these numbers, A n squared. Right? So this typical value, in principle, depends on my initial state. And this is not thermalization. Right? Because what is thermalization? Thermalization is the fact that I take some state, and at the end of my process, this goes into this state. And there are infinitely many states that have, that can correspond to the same Gibbs state. The Gibbs state depends only on one parameter, right? Beta, the temperature. But here, we have that our expectation values, A bar, depend on all these initial quantities, on all the phi nn. So thermalization is more than equilibration. Thermalization is I have to forget my initial state. The only thing that I do not forget is its energy, because energy is conserved. But anything else, that's why in the Gibbs state there. That's why in the Gibbs state there is only one parameter. Beta tells you something about the initial energy. It's the initial average energy. Because it's the Gibbs state depends on one parameter because there is one conserved quantity. So thermalization means I must forget a lot. Equilibration is much weaker. It just says that I don't forget anything because we have not forgotten anything. We are keeping all these initial probabilities, but they statistics is such that when I measure an observable, it has always, in time, the same value. It has equilibrated. So that's why we're not done. We just know that things equilibrate. But do they equilibrate to their thermal value? Is it possible that this A bar, let me pull this back. Is it possible that A bar, which is by definition trace of A phi bar, is also equal to the trace of A in e to the minus beta h over z? This is the question. And the answer cannot be always yes. Because if it was always yes, this would mean that phi bar is this state. But phi bar is not that state. As I said, this remembers the past. This does not remember the past. So it cannot be always, but it's never. Or there are conditions under which these equilibrated values can be the thermal values. The answer is yes, and what we will do later. But now let's come to your question. So you say, oh, the assumptions. So we made an assumption on the spectrum of the Hamiltonian that is non-degenerate, and it has also non-degenerate gaps. So definitely, I can find examples in which I take a degenerate Hamiltonian or Hamiltonian with non-degenerate gaps, and I do not get equilibration. OK, so in what sense my assumption is reasonable? So who gives the Hamiltonian? So nature gives the Hamiltonian, right? The Hamiltonian describes some physical system. and how likely it is that my Hamiltonian has a degeneracy or has degenerate gaps. Well, we have learned that you can have degeneracies only if there are some symmetries or if there is some topological order, right? And even in that case, we saw that the number of degeneracies in topological order is small. It just depends on the topology of the system. It's not an extensive degeneracy. But for a generic system, there is no symmetry. All symmetries are broken. You just know it from the fact that you just take a Hamiltonian that has a degeneracy, then you perturb it with a random operator, and a random operator will lift all the degeneracies. In other words, operators that have a symmetry are a set of measure zero in the space of all operators. So they are very unlikely. That's why these two assumptions are not strong at all. They are very good assumptions. So we have proven, you know, without much doubt, that reasonable observables in reasonable Hamiltonians do equilibrate to these values that are very well defined. And now what is left to show is under which conditions also this is true. And this is a much harder beast. Okay, but at least we've done a part of it. Okay, yes?
We said here, like, in order to have this exponential decaying bound, we need our initial state to be like a linear companion of.
Sorry, come again? I understand.
Like, when we said this bound is exponentially decaying, it was 10 to the power of 23.
This one?
Yeah.
So, it is this part that you don't know?
No. I'm asking, like, you said we need to have our initial state as a linear companion of as many as.
Yeah.
But is this always the case? Like, what happens if I don't have this?
Oh, no, then it's not true. Then if your state is the superposition of, if your initial state, you prepare it, you decide, is the superposition of two energy eigenstates, and you are in a closed system, your system will oscillate between those two states. What I mean is that the expectation value of any of my observable will oscillate between the expectation value of that observable in those two states. And you observe that in the lab. But it is, in fact, very difficult to, in the lab, to prepare an initial state that is the superposition of few energy eigenstates for an extended system. Why? Because it would mean that your system is a system in which your degrees of freedom are the energy. In other words, a free system. Oh, everything commutes. So you prepare your state in an eigenstate of a local operator, and that corresponds to a specific value of the energy. But this is the smallest interaction will make any eigenstate of an observable, which is what you can prepare, a very big superposition in the energy eigenbasis. The other possibility is that your system is from the beginning in a very small Hilbert space. And is few particles, two particles, three particles. Well, then, yeah, it does not equilibrate in a closed system. But that's we know that. That's not a problem. The problem of statistical mechanics, or in this case of quantum statistical mechanics, is to show that equilibration is ensued for a large system. There is no conceptual problem in the fact that for a small system, closed system, things do not equilibrate, right? A pendulum does not equilibrate. In order to equilibrate, you need pendulum plus air, and air is 10 to the 23 particles.